Joining me now is Murray Weatherston. Murray is a founding member of CIFA, and he's been in charge of looking after a lot of the submissions the association's been making on the Financial Advisors Review Act. And for those of you who follow Good Returns closely, you'll know that he quite regularly comments on articles around regulation. So Murray's going to talk to us today about the Financial Advisor Review Act and where it's going and some of his thoughts on it. So welcome, Murray. Thanks for joining us here.
Good to be here.
Thank you. Now, tell me, one of the things that you said in your submission and when you started is that the officials weren't going to listen to you. What's your view on that? Do you think they've listened?
I'd be very surprised. I think they've been heavily captured by the big end of town. The people doing the review didn't actually have very much experience in the financial sector, let alone financial advice. And I just think they've been captured completely by the big end of town.
So one of the issues is they just don't have the experience, do they? They're just policy analysts. They don't know anything. I don't know if any of them have a financial advisor.
We did ask some of them early on in the piece, and no, I'm not even sure they had any financial product.
Oh, really? So they're coming from a zero base.
Absolutely.
So how can you actually draft new regulation when it's like that?
Well, you have to ask the government that. But they seem to have taken the view that you don't need to know anything about the subject that you're going to regulate. All you need to know about is this magic thing called policy analysis.
Policy analysis, yeah, well, interesting, isn't it? One of the views of, you know, one of the goals of the review is to try and get rid of some of these acronyms and make the financial advice system, if you like, more accessible to the public. Do you think where they're going is going to achieve that?
Well, if changing the acronyms of AFA, RFA and QFE to FA, FAR and FAP makes a difference, then I'll be very, very surprised. Clearly, I think what they're trying to do is to make it easier and easier for the big end of town, that's the banks, the insurance companies, you know, the big institutions, to sell their product to the to their customers. And you know, whereas we at the little end of town or the small end of town, what we're really in is trying to advise customers as to what we think is the best thing for them to do.
So you were saying before that, you know, as long as they disclose all these things, that they work for a bank, they're going to sell a bank product, et cetera, et cetera, they might get paid commission, they might get a bonus,
right.
And then they can just go and sell the product, and that's advice?
That's right, it's called advice. And I think there's the Chief Justice, the retired Chief Justice of Australia, Sir Anthony Mason, put it in words, you know, as well as I could put them. Talking about Australia, he said, our system of regulation proceeds on the footing that the advisor may be a product seller. Indeed, our system enables the product seller to adopt the disguise of a financial advisor and endows that disguise with the aura of legitimacy by calling him a, if I put the New Zealand words in, financial advice representative. And that, you know, sums it up to me.
Yeah, it's pretty damning, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I mean, one of the things in the review was whether or not there should be a separation between sales and advice. I didn't have any problems with the bank selling its own product to its customers, so long as the customer knows that they're getting a sale. In the same way that if I go into a Toyota car plant, I'm going to be sold a Toyota.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
I don't expect to be sold a Ford or a Holden or whatever, and we know that's the way that it works. But I think what they're trying to do, and I like those words that endowing the disguise with the aura of legitimacy. It's almost saying that what the banks are doing actually isn't selling.
Yeah.
When in fact we know it's selling.
Totally.
But the people in the review team just didn't seem to accept that at all.
So it's like that boat has sailed, isn't it? The sales versus advice thing. It's nearly too late.
Oh, I would say so. I'd say the big shape of what the new regime will be is already written in stone, and the chances of getting any changes is, you know, well nigh zero.
Yeah, you're also very hot on the website around putting the client's interests first, and I think you made the comment that it was one of the areas that you actually agreed with the officials, but you could end up being on the wrong side of.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right, because I mean, what the code has always said is you have to put the interest of the client first. And everybody's gone on saying, yeah, that's what it is. But no one can actually define what exactly it is. It's one of these sayings where everybody, they don't understand it. They know what the words are, but they don't actually know what the words mean. And what the government, or what the exposure draft did, is codified what it meant. And it limited it to the circumstances where there was a conflict of interest between the client and the advisor.
And then the Code Committee itself came out with a pretty wishy-washy response.
Well, the Code Committee came out and said, well, you know, no, what's in the exposure draft is actually too narrow. It narrows down what we, you know, what we mean by putting the client's interest first. Well, they've had 8 years and they've never defined it. And the things that I found absolutely amazing, given that this is going to go into a statute and there's going to be a statutory duty for advisors, they said things like...
It's aspirational.
So it's only an aspirational goal. It's a philosophical goal. And the most amazing one to me was saying it was actually never intended to be argued in a court of law anyway. Now, to me, if I have a statutory duty, I'm liable to be pinged for failing to meet that duty. I actually want to know what that duty is. I don't want to find myself in a situation where what I thought it was, it wasn't, because someone else thought it meant something else.
And a lot of advisors haven't engaged in this debate, and yet that's, to me, I would have thought it was one of the most critical parts of the legislation.
Yeah, I hate to be critical of my fellow advisors, but I think a lot of them have just sat back and either thought someone else will solve this for me, or taken an even more pessimistic view, was it doesn't really matter whether I get engaged or not. I mean, that's the Brent Sheather view, is it's wasting your time doing it, so just don't do it. But I think advisors could find, you know, themselves having to face things that they don't really like when the final shape is known.
But then, you know, they could also end up in court quite easily.
Oh, yeah, but I think some of them are saying, oh, it won't be me. It'll be that other person will be there. And if they get caught, well, that's their fault.
Yeah, but that's like, you know, when those two cars have a head-on collision, they say, you know, it's never going to happen to me, but it was the other guy's fault.
Yeah, absolutely.
So coming to the Code Committee, I understand a lot of people put their names forward. You got the Don't Come Monday letter.
We didn't actually get the Don't Come Monday letter. We got the letter, you wasted your time because we were never going to consider you anyway.
But shouldn't have they told you that at the start?
Well, that's what I've made the point to them about that, and to their credit, they've actually said it was a fair point.
But they won't reimburse you for your time. No. Who do you think should be on the Code Committee? How should it be made up of?
Well, I mean, I'd hate to think that it's made up of, you know, academics, do-gooders, and people who have no real understanding of what the industry is about. You know, I hope there's a decent practitioner representation in it, so that, you know, what the code comes up with is actually sensible and workable, rather than some theoretical stuff that somebody's got out of some journal somewhere.
Yeah. Should there be any consistency or continuity between the current Code Committee and this one, the new one?
Well, I know that there are actually some members of the existing Code Committee who applied for the new one and got Don't Come Monday letters.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's not automatic. I know the current chairman of the current code is at least in with a chance for the new code. But I don't actually think it matters that the individuals be the same, so long as the approach is the same.
So it's a consistency of approach rather than people.
Because if the Code Committee came in, or the Code Working Group rather, came in and said, oh, we're now going to have a completely different structure for the code, we're going to throw out everything that's been done for investment advisors, we're going to throw all that out and we're going to start from scratch for everyone, I think that would be a bad move. My hope is that they use the model of what they've got for investment advisors and take the clauses for ethics and client care and CPT and extend them across to the other disciplines.
It makes little sense to me that, you know, authorised financial advisors have to do all these things, but everyone else giving advice in other parts of the industry, whether it's insurance or mortgages, don't have to live by the same standards. I don't understand that.
No, and on equitable grounds, that doesn't seem right.
Yeah.
I mean, if investment advisors had to meet level 5, then I would think mortgage advisors have to meet level 5. General insurance advisors have to meet level 5, personal insurance advisors have to meet level 5, and so on.
So basically level five should be the minimum across the industry. Is that your position?
That would be my position, and it's really based on the fact that that's what it was for investment advisors, right? So therefore everyone else should have to be that. The issue then becomes, well, what are the alternative qualifications that they'll accept? And that's where I suspect a lot of argy-bargy been. But if that debate is actually run by the academics and the Skills New Zealand people, I reckon they'll get it wrong.
That would be a tragedy, wouldn't it? It's one of the other issues which has been quite a topical one is this transitional licensing period through to licensing. It seems it's very very unclear how you're going to get to the after the transitional stage and what you actually have to do. Do you have any views on that?
Well, I think it's clear that from February 2019, if you're in the game, you'll get, as a firm, you'll get a transitional license. It's sort of what I'd call, if you can put breath on the mirror, you'll get your transitional license. You'll then have 2 years to apply for your full license. The thing is, what's not known is what are you going to have to do to get the full license? And I think the reason they have that transitional period, they'll hate me for saying it, but I think it's because they couldn't actually get their head around it. Yeah. So what they've done is they've kicked the can down the road for a couple of years and they'll figure it out along the way.
That's not quite the best way to do it. It's going to be fascinating to see, how that goes. It seems to me that, what we're doing here in New Zealand is following Australia a little bit and moving the licensing from the individual to the firm. Is that the right approach?
Well, in 2008, they thought the right approach was to authorise the individual because that's where all the responsibility would be. If you look at accountants, that's individual responsibility. If you look at lawyers, that's individual responsibility. If you look at doctors, it's individual responsibility. Financial advisors, it was individual authorisation. Now it's actually going to go to firm licensing. And I suspect that's done for the benefit of the regulator because there are fewer firms to regulate than there are advisors to regulate.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I guess I'd suggest that there'd be no way that the regulator would have the resources to actually do all the individuals.
Yeah, and maybe they don't have the resources to do all the firms either.
So what do they do there?
Resource up or take a shortcut.
Tommy, who's got the most to worry about in these changes coming up?
Well, my pick is that probably won't be much change for AFAs, right? The investment advisor people, because they've already been through it. I think the biggest change is going to be for the registered but not authorised financial advisors, the people that everyone's called RFAs. I think they're going to find for the first time they have a qualification, right, which will be level five. I would argue it should be level five on the grounds that that's where investment advisors were. They're going to be facing a code of conduct for the first time. I think there's much more change going to occur for the non-investment people than there is for the investment people.
So, and it seems to me a lot of those people have had their head in the sand throughout this review process.
That I've actually tried to wake them up.
I've tried too, but it's... I think it's easier getting my child out, my teenager out of bed than some of these guys.
And I don't want to be too critical, but I think IFA and PAA didn't really represent those people too well. My criticism of them is they were spending too much time in the review process trying to carve out a position for themselves in the regulatory scheme going forward than actually to represent the members.
How much do you think the industry has spent on these regulatory changes?
Well, I had a guess a while ago that for AFAs, up until now, it's something over $100 million.
And the cost benefit?
The benefit, I think, is very light at this point in time. I mean, if the consumer is still confused, if they're still saying they don't know where they need to go to get investment advice and all the rest of it, then there can't have been too much benefit.
And so
I would say, I would score it that the cost has way exceeded the benefits to date. And look, it's not impossible that going forwards, the cost of the other 25,000 people getting up to speed with what the regulations are, the cost of that won't be insignificant.
as a much bigger universe, so it's going to be much more. So personally, you know, you've put a lot of your own time and effort into this. What's driven you to do that?
Part of it was going to influence the environment of where what I had to do in my own firm.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess partly, you know, as a 64-year-old advisor looking back, it's actually giving something back to the profession.
You're putting a huge amount of time. So, and you know, finally, I mean, a lot of your focus has been on the small end of town.
Yeah.
What do you think the future is for that part of the industry?
I think it's very poor.
Mm-hmm.
I think going forwards, look, if I was 40 years of age, right, I've been a sole practitioner. If I was 40 years of age as a sole practitioner, I would say there is no way in Hades that I have a chance of continuing to age 60 in my current shape, and it says the cost is just too large.
Mm.
The requirements that they seem to think you have to have. I mean, as a sole practitioner, should I need procedure manuals?
No.
I would argue not, but dollars to donuts, the regulator would require a sole practitioner to have a procedure manual.
Well, we've seen that through, you know, what they've done with AFAs and what they've done through DIMS and things like that, that apparently everything has to be codified and written in manuals stuff.
And that's so, that to me, that's more so that when the regulator comes in to monitor you, they can actually see what you do. And it's because they don't know what advisors do that they actually need, you know, a manual for them to actually go and tick to say, in your manual you said you do A, B and C. I can see you've done A, show me how you've done B, show you what you've done C. Whereas if they knew something about the industry, they'd be able to go in and instantly see whether the person was, you know, doing what they said they were.
It's always seemed to me that financial advice is as much an art as it is a science.
Well, it's not a science. It really is an art.
Yeah.
And it's actually, a lot of financial advising is based around relationships.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the best definition I've ever seen of what financial planning is, it says it's a process whereby we determine whether and how best we can achieve our lifestyle objectives through a sensible use of our financial resources.
Yeah.
Right? That's not a science.
No.
That is clearly art.
Mm.
And people are different.
That's actually a very good description. I haven't heard that one before.
You can borrow it.
I can borrow it, thank you.
the royalties will come.
Yeah. So and I guess in the future, you know, with this review, we've got a few dates coming up, so people might be able to set their retirement dates.
That's right.
I guess.
Absolutely. Mm. I think a lot of people will say, hey, this is, a lot of people at the small end of town will actually say, hey, this is just getting too hard.
So
I tried my best, but I just can't beat City Hall.
Yeah, so at the end of the day, the big end of town wins.
Oh, absolutely.
And it becomes a corporatized business.
That's right. And what happens, I think, is people, you know, the big end of town sells their product through, you know, the guise of advice.
Yeah.
It just doesn't seem right to me.
No. Look, it's going to be fascinating to see where it turns up, and there's been some really interesting stuff in there. So thank you very much for your time, and I know a lot of people have appreciated all the work and effort you've put in, and also, you know, getting into the debates on the site as well. So that's been great. Thank you, Murray.
Thanks, Joel.
Cheers.